Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 16th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Negritude na Biblia e na Igreja. What? Session 1 of Global Mission in the 21st Century, presented by Peter Nash, number NAP 2003-06. Let's listen in.
Good afternoon. Thanks for coming today. I'm going to try to stay awake and try to keep you awake as well. I was with my two boys yesterday afternoon and last night walking down Railroad Creek Trail to Lucerne, and they weren't really happy about being with me. It took a little more energy than I expected. And as I already mentioned, the last time I walked there was in 1994, and I guess I'm a little older than I was then. But that sort of, as the transition, my name is Peter Nash, and this is the first of three sessions I'll do this week. Tonight, tomorrow at about the same time, and then in the first session on Friday, because I'll be leaving on Friday, on global mission in the 21st century, or actually, from my perspective, global mission at the very end of the 20th century, at the beginning of the 20th century, because I'm not a missionary anymore. As of June 30th, it's my last day working. And July 1st, I landed in Florida, picked up my kids, and came out here. So this is my transition point back into the consumer economy. But in 1994, I was summer teaching staff coordinator. I spent the whole summer out here. It was great. And the end of the first or second week, I got a letter with the DLCA, Division for Global Mission. What do you call that letter?
Letterhead.
And I thought, oh gosh, what is this? I had a stack of mail that day. I threw to the bottom of the pile and thought, I'll deal with this later. As it turns out, it was a letter, a copy of a letter in Portuguese. A translation of that letter to Spanish, and then a translation of parts of it to English, and a letter inviting me to consider a position teaching as an educational missionary in São Leopoldo do Rio Grande do Sul, which is the southernmost state of Brazil, and which is the cradle of German immigration in Brazil. And no, it wasn't in 1945. It was in 1824. And after a struggle for a little more than a year, I signed a contract with DGM and spent 8 years down there. Most of it wonderful, but it's real, not all of it was wonderful. I was talking to someone on the bus on the way up there. It is the worst weather in all of Brazil. It's hot and humid in the summer, and cold and rainy in the winter. Currently it's the mold season. You can't keep your walls dry, it's cold and damp, and so the mold goes on the walls, even in the nicest homes. So it wasn't all paradise, but I really had a great time down there. And if anybody is here because they're considering serving the village as a missionary, I would encourage you to follow up with that. I know that there's one woman who's going to Kenya in August. She's she's working with the youth, I guess. It's exciting to see other people go. I wish I'd be one. Well, there, it was a great time in my life. And I'm glad it's over. I'm happy to be back in the States, but I had a great time. So, what did I do down there for 8 years? I mentioned that the letter in English, parts of the letter in English were badly translated, or maybe intentionally mistranslated. I could never figure out whether they sent me there because they were tired of me hanging around in the States, or because they actually thought I could do a good job. The problem with translation was in Brazilian Portuguese, substituir looks like substitute. And so in the English translation, It said a substitute. We need a substitute professor because the one of the Old Testament professors has been named dean or rector for the next 4 years, or was named last year as rector for these this 4 year block. And I knew that by the time I would get there, it'd be 2 years. And I thought they needed someone to substitute. In American academic English, you say you a substitute professor means someone's on sabbatical, or someone is going to be the dean. And so you need someone just for that time. You know? Turns out that sustituir in Spanish and Portuguese means replacement. And so I was, you know, 10 months into negotiation and conversation before I realized that they were looking for someone a little longer term than I had initially intended to go. So that first contract was for 30 months, figuring out. Negotiate my 18 months to 2 years, and we negotiated in the 3 months, and I just kept renewing. I was a contract missionary rather than a handbook missionary, which doesn't mean a lot in this conversation. It means that I had some things, I had some needs that many missionaries, most missionaries don't need, and I didn't have other needs that most missionaries need. And so I was never standard in that. Made me able to do some things that made me need to do some things that others couldn't do. So yeah, that's one way of saying that. Often Division for Global Mission, for those of you who are members of the ELCA or have passed through the ELCA at one time or another, can be flexible depending on one's needs and the needs in the place of service. I've been rambling so fast. Any questions, clarifications so far?
You were teaching at a university there?
Or? I was teaching at Escola Superior de Teologia, basically Theological High School or Theologische Hochschule, which is parallel to the German Hochschule, not to our high school. Right? It's for people who are in at least their first degree of university level, but it was a theological school. It is the second largest theological and educational institution in the World Federation, Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, being the largest. And if you, the CUNY study, I'm very proud of the changes that took place there.
Is it multilingual? Is that one
again? Well, it's tech course classes are taught in, it's very multilingual. Classes were taught until 1970 in German. It's a church that is 90% German, 98% European descent. And so in 1997, my second year on the faculty, we finally had more books in Portuguese than German in the library. It took us 27 years to get there. Because up until 1970, just about everything was all books were purchased in German. A lot of the students come from the countryside, from out in the sticks, like where I'll be going to. I just accepted a job in Waverly, Iowa, and having some culture shock just to get used to saying that I'm going to Iowa. My apologies to those of you who are from or in Iowa. But
that would be me.
It's really a nice place.
Is it?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. The one thing that I keep promising my wife is that the sweet corn is really, really good.
Yeah.
these are isolated villages in many cases where the kids come from, the students come from. And so they grow up speaking basically two dialects of German that basically don't exist anymore. Pomeranisch, half of which is in Poland now. And I was just to tease them, you're not German, you're Polish. And Hunstrich, from the other side of Germany, over in the Rhine region, for some reason, apparently, I don't know what the reasons were, but this is where in 1824, when the emperor of Portugal, Brazil, which had already separated from Portugal, invited the poor Germans and Italians. The Germans came basically from these two regions, and they settled in the south of the country where the Portuguese / Brazilians were needing buffer and cheap labor to replace the slave labor and to stand as a buffer between the Argentines and those who would become the Uruguayos, who were trying to get back the property that the Brazilians had stolen from the Spanish. So those are the Germans who came down there, and a lot of students still
come from households where they don't learn Portuguese, which is the national language, until they go to school at five, six, or seven. So when they come to us, a lot of times little groups will form and they, for good and for bad reasons, fall back in the regional dialect. The regional dialect, you know, sort of like we joke. We talk about some parts of Appalachia speaking English dialects and English accents that are more like Elizabethan than anything spoken in England. Also, our students, it's a regional seminary. So my first 4 years there, we had full-time, you know, full program students from Venezuela, from Chile, from Peru, Angola, so a different dialect of Portuguese. And the Spanish-speaking students, there are other Spanish-speaking dialects in the graduate school, but the Spanish-speaking students are allowed to write in Spanish. They don't have to write in Portuguese, so it was a lot of fun for me. My first couple years, grading papers. My Spanish when I got there was actually much better than my I had like 10 days of Portuguese before I went down there. And then I had a 6-month intensive course in another city where the dialect is completely different. It's like going to New York to teach in Alabama. But me, everybody got over that. My students joked a couple weeks ago, well, we just understand you now. On Friday morning, I'm going to talk more about theological education from my experience and talking about some of the things I've heard and maybe making up some of the things I think some of my colleagues should have said about theological education around the world, because that's a big part of what mission is for CLC right now, lending seminary professors, college professors, English in Asia, a lot of simply English professors around the world. But I'll talk mostly about theological education and what we learn, or what I learned at any rate, and what some others have learned about theological education, how theology is changing, how it's no longer an export product, but I hope it's becoming a partnership, a two-way street. Some interesting things about that in Brazil, but we'll hold that for Friday, and maybe some of you will come back. Mission today is just going to say it's a lot different from what a lot of people think of when we say missionary. If some of you, one of you got a seemingly rude letter from me somewhere along the line because you're a Sunday school teacher and you sent letters asking, well, what's your mission like? How do you, we're talking about mission and missionaries in Sunday school. How does it feel to tell people about Jesus? What is it like in the Amazon and things like that? And I wrote back saying, I'm nowhere near the Amazon. Everybody I know is Christian. This is who we are. Please write to the president or your senator or your congressman and ask him to stop this program or that, which is causing these problems down here. If you got one of those letters, I'm kind of sorry. Most ELCA missionaries today are not involved in what we think of in the old days of mission service of saving souls. We're kind of a step away from that kind of direct action. In a country like Brazil or all over Latin America, almost everybody is Christian. They may not be Lutheran, they may not be Protestant, but you know, Brazil is overwhelmingly Roman Catholic. And in a lot of places up until about 30 years ago, it was illegal to proselytize, sheep steal, whatever one, evangelize, because the Roman Catholic Church was so powerful that those kinds of things were not advisable. During the military dictatorship from 60, which we financed, by the way, from 64 till 80 to early 80s, for example, the Germans were prohibited from speaking German. Because I never understood why, but it was one of the things that couldn't be controlled, is my imagination. in the early years in Brazil, babies who were baptized, babies who were born of marriages performed in the Lutheran churches, babies who were baptized in the Lutheran churches were considered bastard children and were not considered baptized. That was until the early 20th century. So some of my students still had living memory from grandparents, great-grandparents who told these stories. During, kind of jumping back, but during the military dictatorship, it scared me. There were frightening stories about people who were turned in for, pastors who were turned in for preaching in Germany at the funeral of a parishioner whose widow only understood German. But in times of repression, as we all know, people turn people in for the silliest things. So that's a picture of who they are, a little more of who they are. Missionaries are much more involved in education, support positions, administration, bookkeeping, medical situations, especially in Africa. Not that they're not needed in South America, but the need is so much more pressing these days in most parts of Africa. And so that's where we're involved. But theological education is something that's happening pretty much around the world with ELCA missionaries. And that's not different. If you're not Lutheran, don't just turn me off. It happens in the Presbyterian Church. It happens in the UCC Church. It happens in the Episcopal Church. All of the churches have, except for what I would call the more evangelical to fundamentalist churches who are out there trying to finish off the conversion of the world in order to bring about the eschaton. Most of the mainline churches are involved in a different kind of missionary endeavor for the last 20, 25 years. Some people think it's a good idea, others think it's not such a good idea. One thing I know is that Brazilians know a lot better than I do how to bring the word face-to-face to other Brazilians. These things are all quite cultural in ways that we can't imagine until we've lived in one or more cultures. Just the way we frame the questions, some of you have noticed, are quite different as to what is Christian, what is Christianity. And a funny example which might be frightening to us is that the joke in Brazil is that they did a survey and found out that 150% of Brazilians are religious. because Candomblé, which the closest parallel that we have, some sort of an idea, although for most of it's a really bad and unclear idea, it would be voodoo in Haiti, in Haiti. And this, if you're from Chicago, maybe Santeria from the Caribbean, Spanish-speaking Caribbean, which has a mixture of indigenous African religions with or practices with an overlay of Roman Catholic piety, so that the saints and even Jesus represent different orishas or orishas, depending on which pronunciation one uses. Different entities from those traditional religions. And so a lot of Afro-Brazilians, a lot of Afro-Caribbeans are Catholic, and they're in church every Sunday, and they believe, and they are, in the case of Brazil, candomblistas, which means on Friday or Saturday night they're in the fest of the party with the Mãe dos Santos, the Mother of the Saints, and they dance the night away. Some of them in what would be a prophetic, would be parallel to Old Testament prophetic trance, believing that they are possessed, not in a bad way, by their patron entity or spirit. And some of them are even Roman Catholic and Canobista and Lutheran. So that's how we get to 150%. Everybody has at least one religion. I know Pat Robertson
go have a plastic with that. And my mother too. I would have at one point, but having seen how it works in Brazil, I'm much more comfortable with it than I would have than I was when I first went to Brazil. I tend to run and then stop. So I'm going to stop and read for a minute and see if there are any questions or clarifications.
I had heard that there's quite a movement of charismatic, fundamental, religious movements in South America.
Every sociologist of religion in Brazil is studying the neo-Pentecostal movement. And it's quite large. Unfortunately, in my opinion, one part of it is the church of the Reign of God. Church of the Reign of God, which is the neo-Pentecostal movement out of Miami, which is very much a church religion of glory. That God is wonderful and is going to make you rich. And what's happening, and their insertion, they are better than Coca-Cola. You know, Coca-Cola is everywhere. These guys are everywhere, and another 5 miles down the road. Places where the traditional mainline churches won't go, some for political, practical reasons. I mean, how do you support a worker in the church? How do you get somebody to go out there where you have no financial means to support him or her? And since this is a sort of popular grassroots movement, and I preach for an hour and a half, and then I pass the plate around, and you say, so I'll stop. but they are there, really, at the end of the world, they are there.
So now, do you see the same kind of people holding on to their Catholicism and participating in that?
Yeah. And it's an interesting phenomenon because the preachers were, the first year I was there in 1995, the bishop of this church went on television. Actually, they bought up one of the Brazilian networks. When I was in Mozambique in an exchange program, they were selling or giving, I don't know how it worked, but their transmissions were showing up in Mozambique. So they're pushing themselves not only around all of Brazil but all of Portuguese-speaking Africa, they're quite a phenomenon. But the point is that in a country like Brazil that has such a deep piety and such a deep reverence for the Virgin Mary, he denounced idolatry and kicked the statue of Mary 17 times on national television. Denouncing this Catholic heresy, and came around to almost apologize, but there's a lot of denouncing of that part of Catholicism, or Catholicism as sort of sort of super Lutheranism. Yeah, frankly, I mean, a lot of times, and especially in Brazil, I noticed that. We identify ourselves as Lutherans by not being Catholic. Mm-hmm. What we are is not Catholic. Well, in this case, it's stronger. Maybe it's only because we're Americans, or maybe a different kind of polite. But these guys are like, this is Satan at work here. All those statues around the sacristy and nave are idols, and we have to get rid of them. Sort of super Calvinist in that sense. Every sociologist of religion is making his or her career right now studying neo-Pentecostal movement. It's really amazing. That's about all they're studying right now, if they're Brazilians, because there's been such a dramatic change, a dramatic upsurge. Families are more important in Brazil than most Americans can imagine. And so, that's part of the reason people hang on to various traditions. Don't want to hurt mom or grandma or granddad, but this is more useful for me. Another phenomenon is spiritism. I still haven't figured out who Allan Kardec is, but I'm pretty sure is a name that's known to some people in the United States. That's another movement that's very big, reincarnation. Next slide is the spiritual spirit kind of professes up, almost sounding Eastern in some ways. Anything else? What did I say last meeting?
You said you were at a seminary.
Right.
These students that graduate from there, what will they be ordained pastors, and then where do they end up going, and what church are they in?
This is the IE.
You write it down. Mm-hmm.
Igreja Evangelica da Confessão Luterana no Brasil. The Church of the Evangelical Church of the Lutheran Confession in Brazil. The other Lutheran church in Brazil is Evangelical Lutheran Church in Brazil. And this is a church that started in 1909 with strong support and still strong ties to the Lutheran Church and the Synod here in the United States. This church actually formed itself in the 1940s. I can't remember what the date is. We merged in this case, several different groups that have been existent with regional connections. If you know the story of the history of the German Lutheran churches, every state, what we would call state, every state in Germany has its own regional church. And so they had a lot of regional connections, and they, in the 1940s, they formed themselves into this church. And they became, and those churches in Germany are both Reformed and Lutheran, and sometimes both, which sounds sort of odd. Well, it doesn't sound so odd to those of us who are Lutheran now, because it was in 1997 when we finally moved to full communion with at least three of the Reformed churches in the United States. If you're from Michigan, like I am, it's kind of weird. But if you're from Pennsylvania, it's probably not so strange. If you're driving down a country road, some country roads in Pennsylvania, and suddenly you see Grace UCC Church on one side of the street and Grace Lutheran Church on the other side of the road. And you find out that until 1966, they were the same church, and then they finally got enough money and they separated because one pastor, one group remembered their Lutheran groups, another remembered their Reformed groups. And they finally separate when they have the financial means to do that. And so they were trying to be faithful to both parts of their tradition. The stronger group was Lutheran. Lutheran confession, but they didn't want to call themselves a Lutheran church because they wanted to respect the Reformed beliefs of some of the colleagues. Today they talk more freely and almost exclusively about being Lutheran. In my time there, I don't think I heard another person. I went to a Presbyterian seminary, so I talked about John Calvin probably more than any of my colleagues did, even though I come from a Lutheran church and they come from a church that understands itself in its history as a joint church of the two traditions. Where they go physically, just imagine that Brazil actually looks like that. Rio Grande do Sul is the southernmost state. Santa Catarina is the small state. And then Paraná, and this would be Argentina. Argentina comes, swings in like that. Paraguay and Uruguay here. Foz do Iguaçu is here, the juncture of these three countries. Almost all of the Lutheran churches, or the ESLVA churches in Brazil, are in these three southern states. It's a very regional church. And that's one of its problems. That's one of the reasons. Most of the Germans in Brazil, they're Teuto Brasileiros, the German descended Lutherans. Brazilians live in these three states. And then up here in Espírito Santo, Rio de Janeiro being the state, São Paulo being here. Up in this region, also in the 19th century, that mostly the Pomeranish, but there are also Pomeranish down here, came in. And then in the 1960s and 70s, there was a migration out of the south and out of the east coast for farming was just really bad. And there was a lot of free land as the government tried to open up Rondônia. Rondônia, the Rio the Madeira River runs out of Puerto Berry, the capital city of Rondônia, and runs up here and then hooks up with the Amazon. So it's right on the edge of it's the beginning of the Amazon basin. So there was a significant Lutheran presence there. What an ugly map. Most of the students will go here. The graduates will go to this region where most of the churches are. A few will go up here, especially if they're from the Pomeranus tradition, which is a slightly different, it's a more Lutheran tradition, and more decidedly Lutheran in its own historical roots. But especially if they speak Pomeranus, they'll probably go back up here. There are Pomeranus here, and there are Pomeranus in the south as well. A few will go up here. In the last 10, 15 years, there's a congregation that everybody wants to go to, a couple congregations that everybody wants to go to up here in Salvador, Bahia. Recife. Let's say it's further north. In Natal. These are great beach towns. These are ugly beaches down here. So everybody wants to go there, but unfortunately, for the most part, these have not been outreach churches. They've been, as the whole church is a migrant church, and held on to its German roots for a long time. There was a real struggle in the 1930s and 40s as to whether or not they would support National Socialism. It was almost evenly divided between we are German, we do what the motherland, the fatherland does, and those who were associated with the Confessing Church and the movement, the most best known person would be Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Only by a little bit did they go in what we would say was the right direction. And not become a church that was totally aligned with the position of a government that was doing some very odd things. Anybody here grew up in Missouri besides me? I grew up in the Missouri Synod, and I was regional president of the Walker League for most of my high school years. It's not like one time. I was only in high school 3 years, or two of my three high school years. And only at the end of that time that I realized that the Walker League was established in large part to make sure that Lutheran youth met other Lutheran youth and married good Lutheran youth. Now, which doesn't sound so bad today in 2003, but in the 1930s, what this meant was let's make sure that the German girls meet German boys and German boys meet German girls. Because remember, in the Missouri Synod, there were problems during World War I and World War II. As suspicion as to where the political royalties lay. And so it's kind of funny that in the 1970s, I wound up being in Saginaw Valley, which is a very strong, very significant strong fortress, became president of that group. It's worse. A student wrote a paper for me last year in which one of the things that he turned in the first draft of the paper about the church's role in racism in Brazil. And he blamed it all on the Catholics. They said, this is really good. What you're doing is good, but, let's try to be a little self-critical. Let's see what the Lutherans were doing at this time. He didn't go back to the 19th century, but chose to stay with the 20th century, and we were actually in Germany together. I was on sabbatical, he was on an exchange year. So his German is quite good, or at least passed, well, everybody's history pretty much. But his German was good enough that he could research the primary sources of that church. And one of the things he turned in was a Xerox of a page of the official registry of the Youth Ministry Department of the church in 1936. And there are these smiling Germanic faces out in front of the church, all 16, 17, 18, holding the German flag with the swastika, which for me was a really shocking thing. they didn't think of it. I mean, the swastika didn't have all of, in 1936, didn't have all of the, the grab that it has for us in the 21st century. I haven't looked back, being able to look back. But it was clear from the rest of his reporting that was exactly what was supposed to happen. Phrases like "Who marries outside of the faith, outside of the race, disgraces the faith and the family and the nation." So that's the kind of stuff that was floating around in our churches back in the 1930s.
Well, that's.
It's not. Did I finish answering your question about where they go?
Yeah.
I don't know how I got to where I am from there. But it makes sense.
I'm trying to think. Are these Lutherans? Do they look like European Lutherans, or have they intermarried with the native population? And do they look more, South American or whatever?
Most of them, if you set them down in Pennsylvania, the old Pennsylvania Dutch, which is really German, you'd look at them and you wouldn't, until you heard them speak, you wouldn't know that they weren't from central Pennsylvania or central Iowa.
So they stayed amongst themselves and didn't intermingle with the
They are fighting it today. And let me use that as a segue to Negra Tunji na Biblia na Igreja. What?
Yeah.
What did that guy say? What does he mean? I joke sometimes that I was the last great imperialist act of the ELCA and its mission development program. Because what happened before I got that letter in 1994, I went in 95, was a dear friend who died last year, Will Hertzfeld. Some of you may know who he is. Will Hertzfeld went to Brazil once, and they looked at him and they said, "But you're black." And this high-powered mission executive from the United States is coming down, named Will Hertzfeld, Hartfield, and everybody thought, cool, there's another German coming down to talk to us. And this black guy gets off the plane and goes, "What?" And Will is, he chose when he would be delicate and when he wouldn't be. And someone says, "How'd you get that name?" He said, "Well, some German slave owner raped my great grandmother." End of discussion. So Will sat down with Rafael Malpica, who I heard earlier this week has just been named the executive director of the Division for Global Mission, and said, "We really have to do something about these Germans. They're not letting anybody else into the church. They're going to die because they're leaking." I mean, you think the ELCA or the Presbyterians or the UCC, you name it, you think our mainline churches are leaking, these people are leaking at a rate. No, it's sort of a Germanic culture club rather than a church. Or a family chapel in some of these small towns rather than, and they just don't, the concept of going out and inviting people to church for a lot of different reasons that we can talk about in a minute, just is not a ESLJ concept. Apparently they said, "They need an Old Testament professor. Let's send Peter." And I, at that point, had written very little about blacks in the Bible. I'd written some stuff about diversity in the Bible, but they thought that I was the best option that they had. Or maybe they sent that letter to a lot of people, and I was the only one who answered it. But it was clear to me that that's what they wanted me to do. They made that clear. That's what they wanted me to do. I don't know if they told them that.
When you first started talking about the history of how the Germans came to Brazil, to this part of Brazil, I wanted to ask, came up for me, were they persecuted? Were they considered a minority in the culture because of Lutheranism versus the Catholicism?
Absolutely.
So there's a certain way in which, persecuted groups
turned out
together.
There were multiple. Can I help you? Those are mine. um, And they left, I mean, for the some of the same reasons. I mean, it's the same migration that brought us our 19th century German migration. You know, feudalism is over, but I have no property, I have no one's taking care of me, and I don't work for you. Where do I go? Well, the Americas is were an option. And for various reasons, some went to, you know, sometimes it was just the first boat leaving. Sometimes it was, I just heard this last week, I knew this, because some families got split up, got to Ellis Island. This weren't healthy, part of the family wasn't healthy enough, part of the family was, and part would come here, part would go there. It was bad there, and it was bad here, but at least they had property. Because one of the things that they got in the deal, they were invited by the emperor, was a plot of land. They got land. Will and Raphael mess with the invitation to mess with me, and then suddenly there I was in Brazil. I tell this story. I looked a little different when I went down there. But when I got down there, I didn't go to Rio Grande do Sul for language. I went to São Paulo, which is a much broader state. And people ask me, well, yeah, good, Old Testament, fine, but you're not Jewish. No, I'm black. He said, no, you're not. And why are you concerned about all this black stuff? Well, because I'm black. I said, no, you're not. And I kind of liked it at first. And then after a couple months, I was like, I am. And no, you're not. And finally, when I went down to the southern part of the country, I was black again. and then I was kind of pissed about it. I say that to, in part, to illustrate that the lines of race are, the concepts of racialization are completely, not completely different, but they're very different from what they are in the U.S. And it's funny to see how, using the word again, imperialist we are. It's embarrassing to watch African Americans go to Brazil, African Americans who know what black is, to go to Brazil and then tell people that they're black. Because in Brazil, the lines are basically fuzzier. They're different, but they're fuzzier. And so, in one part of Brazil, I'm not black. In another part of Brazil, I'm definitely black. Especially if I try to date your daughter. In other parts of Brazil, yeah, I just, you know, that's how everybody is. You know, you're just Brazilian. It's kind of up in Bahia, another great beach town. You know, I'm just Brazilian until I open my mouth and they hear my. So that was one of the first things I had to deal with. I went to a seminary that was 50 years old. We celebrated the 50th year, the year that I got there. They said they taught in German until 1970. 90% German, 91-92% German, 98% European descent. Had not yet managed to graduate one Afro-Brazilian. Know what we would call Latinos or Latinas from Brazil, from Peru, from Venezuela, fine.
So you ordain women?
Yeah.
And how many students?
Depends on how you count. Residential students, about 270. Residential theological students, about 270. Another 100 students in the music program. About 40 students in the nursing program. About 100 students in the PhD and master's program, and just a whole boucoodle of students in the extension program, which is sort of like DN here. So, in total, I think we end up with about 800 students. First of all, I learned Portuguese, and had its own problems and joys and concerns. But listen a lot and figure out who considers themselves Afro-descendant and why, and who at the seminary might consider him or herself Afro-descendant or black, or whatever term one would use, because the terms, as you know, in our discussion of culture wars, woman said to me, I was coordinating the group at an Association of Black Lutherans about 20 years ago. There was a lady there who was, a woman there who was, you know, 70-ish. So what is it, and the question was, what does it mean to be black? Or maybe African American, it might have been right about that time when we switched from being black to African American. And I said, ma'am, you've been black longer than the rest of us, so why don't you start now? Just trying to be kind of cute and give deference to the seniority. And she said, no, I became black the same time you did, because I grew up colored, and before that I was darky. So, it moves around. It's not a fixed concept. If you want to talk about that some more, buy me a beer, and we'll talk about just how bizarre it is. My current research actually is about how questions of racialization and definitions of race make a difference in biblical interpretation in the United States and in Brazil and Southern Africa. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems to me that it must be increasingly difficult, though, because there are so few pure anything left. I think of the students that I taught that were, I think the first time that I really had a, I was supposed to fill out this form about the ethnicity of students. And the girl was, her mother was Korean, and her father had been in the military and a black soldier. And I think we were never able to find him, but she obviously was able to establish that they could come to this country.
Well, if you're in Korea and you have a black baby, yeah. An Amerasian black baby, it's a pretty clear sign.
Yeah. So that's the first time I really thought about it. When you say, I have friends, very few friends that can say that they're all, I'm all German, I'm all African, and I'm all Hispanic, I'm all this. I mean, it must be very hard to do what you're doing.
Well, it's even harder because if they do say that, they're lying. Because there are no pure races. I mean, there is one pure race, the human race. There are, it's just amazing to me that this myth has hung on as long as it has, in spite of for the last 40 years, science has very clearly shown us. And now that we're doing DNA mapping, it's even clearer. But like, these, Brazil, that's not Germany. Sorry, that one. But like these people whose ancestors came from the eastern border of Germany in the days when Germany was 151 in Princeton, there was no Germany per se, and they came from this little one over in the East Coast, more than half of which is in Poland. So where are they? Even if both of their parents are former Irish, doesn't agree. Well, maybe with dogs there are pure races.
Okay.
There's a lot of that sort of eugenic stuff going on for a long time. But what are they, German or the Polish? How do you make those distinctions?
Where you arbitrarily have drawn a line on the continent and said, this country, this is another country.
And all of those lines have been arbitrary for one reason or another. I mean, if you're, Icelandic for the last, 200 years, that's something, but how do those people get up there? Where do they come from? My wife is a Dane, and even her family, from some little dinky island off of the Salem, not the main part that hooks up with the rest of Europe, but then island off there that, in her lifetime, they put a ferry over to the island. The bridge over there is only less than 10 years. That you can drive over there. Her great great grandfather is Spanish. And he wasn't in the Denmark for very long. Nobody knows his name, they just know he was a Spanish sailor. So it's always been like that. And this idea of race and culture commingled into bloodlines is a rather bizarre one that started somewhere shortly after the Inquisition in Europe. And it was first religious and then transferred to ethnic lines and cultural lines. And I've got footnotes to prove it now. Anything else? So it's kind of murky. And so I have the distinct task in my second year of going up to people. I was kind of tired of paying out and being the only black person there. And I really, I taught a course on blacks in the Old Testament. And I started asking people, you know, some people was easier than others. I mean, some people were just so clearly anti-Semitic. They said, well, why don't you come over and have a coffee and we'll talk about what's going on. And, you know, why is it this place never managed to graduate? Why would anyone? Why would there be black graduate students? And it can be a truly offensive question to ask somebody in Brazil. Are you black? And so I had to kind of walk around in eggshells for a couple of years, for several months. And still, when I left, you know, this last group is a little less complicated. But last year's group, we had a woman who was adopted. No one in the United States would doubt that she was an African descendant. But in Brazil, she had this sort of wiggle room, and she was adopted by a German family, spoke German. So her cultural identity was rural Brazilian Germanic. And she, you know, she didn't want to be part of this group. And I'd invited her, and the students would invite her, and she didn't. And when she got in academic trouble, she wanted to be a part of the group, which I thought was sad, because actually she needed the help, and we could have provided some for her, but she asked us too late, and she's not there anymore. And that's not because we have affirmative action there or anything that you might imagine on an American model. It's just that solidarity, giving your time in the classroom, outside of the classroom, is the way things work there to help everybody get through once you're in some sort of a group. What she didn't understand was that she was being excluded by the people that she thought were her tribe. And another group that she was trying to not be identified with because of the stigma that she perceived, and in part that she threw upon us and upon herself, kept her from finding a group in that moment that could have helped her out. I'm not saying that she could have stayed, or that we were able to work, you know, to work miracles on that, but she turned way too late again. What time is it? What we did, negritude, not Biblia, denigration. Blackness. In the 1930s and 40s, some Senegalese, that's why it's a French word, decided was going on already in the early 1900s with W.E.B. Du Bois, with Marcus Garvey in the United States, but it was sort of a general world movement to try to do something to uplift black peoples all over the place. And one of the words, that, one of the things that stuck from that, Senegalese writer, who was also ambassador to France, I think president of Senegal, was the term negritude, which he defines everything that has to do with the way black people live and identify themselves. So what I set out to do was to establish a research project, which the church there picked up, and especially the seminary supported a great deal, to try to recover the presence of blacks in the Old Testament. In the Bible. We did some stuff with Acts, for example, as well, but my area being Old Testament, I pretty much stuck to home. And in the church, there's a whole lot of stuff about church history. Most church history professors teach the church in Africa from the point of view of the conquerors in the 15th century as the reconquest happened, and Philip the Navigator, and the Navigator sent his people down the coast, inching down the coast until finally, at the end of the 15th century, they got around the Cape, and that was when Christianity came, completely ignoring the fact that in the first century, there's the Coptic Orthodox Church, Ethiopian Orthodox Church, already established on African soil. And so those things, the monastic movement started in Africa. Anthony, the monk who said that the monastic movement was African. And so there's just a lot of stuff that, if you just twist your head a little bit and look at history a little differently, you understand that there's a lot of black presence in church history. Not all of it's positive. You know? That's not my point. My point is that we're there, and it's not a matter that the Europeans brought Christ to us. You know, well, where did Jesus go, according to our tradition, when Herod wanted to kill him and was willing to kill all the babies in Judea and Egypt? He went to Egypt, which I know isn't in Africa in your Bible now. But if you look at a real map of the world, Egypt is in Africa. So if we go off and cut off Egypt and put up in something called the Middle East, which is a very modern invention, and sort of pre-Europe. So but that's where the project was, and that's what I did for 6 of the 8 years that I was there. And if you're interested, I'll be here at 6:25 to talk about some of the other stuff that goes on in mission and kind of finish up these little details about what I was doing in Brazil. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you.